minimum wage, joblessness, food stamps, and Social Security. America's wealth divide has become a chasm, creating a looming social and political crisis for America that undermines any pretense that ours is a democratic society.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Thank you for tuning in to 90.1 KKFI's Eco Radio, and happy St. Patrick's Day. This is Natural Lee, and I have your news headlines. While the U.S. waits on Keystone XL decision, a new tar sands pipeline just got approved. Emily Atkins for ThinkProgress.org writes, Canada's National Energy Board has approved a proposal by Enbridge Inc. to allow the reversal and expansion of their Line 9 pipeline. The reversal means that the pipeline can now carry crude oil east rather than west. The expansion means it can now also carry tar sands oil from Alberta, the same type of oil that would be transported by the Keystone XL pipeline if approved. With the reversal and expansion approved, environmentalists say the controversial tar sands oil can now be pumped almost to the New England border. This is because on one side, Enbridge Line 9 connects to a pipeline that carries tar sands. On the other side, Line 9 connects to a 236-mile-long line pump from Montreal to Portland, Maine. The National Resources Defense Council says that the Portland connection has been targeted by the tar sands industry as a way for getting the oil into the United States via New England. Texas group exceeds signature requirement for fracking ban on the November ballot. Denton Drilling Awareness Group, also known as DAG, which was formed by members of the city's drilling advisory group after their recommendations were largely ignored by the city, launched Frack Free Denton, the fracking ban signature drive on February 20th. Denton City Government, which supports fracking-enabled oil and gas development within city limits, has a track record of ignoring its citizens and giving industry a free rein. Decisions are made in closed sessions without citizen input. Kathy McMullen, DAG president, said, Our city government is clearly more interested in protecting the fracking industry than its citizens. That's why we need to gather as many signatures as possible to show they'll pay a political price if they try to thwart their constituents' wishes. Frack Free Denton announced March 14th that they have gathered substantially more than the required signatures to put their fracking ban initiative on the November ballot. Denton's city charter requires signatures equal to 25% of votes cast in the most recent general election for an initiative to get on the ballot. Earthquake recorded in southern Kansas. The earthquake happened at 3:46 a.m. Sunday, March 16th, and measured 4.0 on the Richter scale. Its epicenter was reported 8 miles east-northeast of Anthony in Harper County. It was at least the second earthquake in a week in the area. On Wednesday, a quake rated 3.4 on the Richter scale was recorded 14 miles east-northeast of Anthony. Governor Sam Brownback last month asked the director of the Kansas Geological Survey to lead a task force that will study whether human activity is causing an increase in minor earthquakes in Kansas. Today's show is hosted by Elaine Giesel. In honor of St. Patrick's Day, it's called Greening Your Beer. We have Mike Ucks, the director of engineering at Boulevard Brewing Company, and Michelle Goth, program manager of Ripple Glass. We'll learn how Boulevard is making their brewery more sustainable and how Ripple Glass is making glass recycling work. Stay tuned and learn about the upcoming Boulevardia, a beer, food, and music festival that will include an eco expo. All of us here at Eco Radio welcome any new listeners we may have who are tuning in to hear what's going on with Boulevard Brewing Company and Ripple Glass.
Hey. All right, Mike, tell me when.
Okay, when you're ready.
All right. This is Elaine Giesel. Welcome to Eco Radio, and happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody. Tonight's program is entitled Greening Your Beer. Not drink green beer, but greening your beer. And we're going to be talking with Mike Utz of Boulevard Beer and Michelle Goth of Ripple Glass. We're going to start with Mike. Mike, tell us what you do at Boulevard.
Good morning, Elaine. I'm the director of engineering at Boulevard. Been there for a little over 15 years now, so I'm in charge of all the processing and and facility work and everything that we do there. And then I'm also principal and co-founder of Ripple Glass.
And we're going to be talking about Ripple Glass in the second half of the show. We'll come back to Michelle at that point. You mentioned you're a facility engineer. What's special about the facility out there? What does that have to do with greening your beer?
Well, that's a good question. We do have a pretty special facility that we've spent lots and lots of years developing. Back in 2005, we designed our new Brewhouse 2 building, as we call it. And it's a real state-of-the-art brewing process, but it's also a fairly state-of-the-art building. We spent a lot of energy trying to make a building that worked for us, for the environment that we were given it from a processing standpoint, but then also to really be good stewards of our environment and making sure that we used all of our utilities properly and took care of everything that we could possibly do in the sense of energy conservation, utilities conservation, and whatnot.
You have a green roof. You grow your hops up on the roof of the brewery or what?
No hops up there, unfortunately. They require quite a different soil mixture than we can put on the roof. But, yeah, we do have a green roof, and that's one that really extends the lifetime of the roof. It takes what would be a 20-year life roof. It extends it up to on the order of 50 years. But it also absorbs up to about an inch of rainfall before it starts overflowing into the city sewer. And I think we all know in Kansas City, Missouri, that's a big issue because of the stormwater and combined sewer, that's a really big issue, and we wanted to be sensitive to that as we were constructing.
What kind of plants are up there?
We have
just
a variety
curious.
Of sedum and grasses, some native grasses like little blue stem and just all types of plants, but nothing really intensive. There's no trees up there except for the little wild ones that the birds drop seeds and they grow out of thin air, but that's about it. No trees or intensive plants. It's a pretty minor landscape.
And it can handle drought and low water, too. I mean, that was the sedum part of it, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right? Yeah, it handles drought. Some of the plants tolerate it a lot better than the others, but, yeah, I think especially we do a lot of construction. You know, we're in constant state of change there as a growing brewery, so we run into times where we have a lot of foot traffic and we run down some plants. So we do some occasional maintenance and repair.
How about heating, air conditioning? That's a big facility.
There's
a lot of stuff going on inside that generates heat, I imagine. How do you handle that? Any special way?
Well, we have a fairly intelligent atmosphere or HVAC, heating, ventilation, air conditioning control system. This system actually adapts and controls spaces independently of one another so that, you know, individuals can have their own space control so without affecting the overall environment and having somebody running the heater right next to a person that's trying to cool themselves down. So we're able to do a little bit of more intelligent control that way. But then we also have separated our brewing processes where all that heat is generated. We separate that and only do natural ventilation in there and some spot heating for the winter times.
Was the building originally designed to do this? Have you done some retrofitting?
Yeah, the building wasn't originally designed. Unfortunately, our team collectively wasn't smart enough to make the right decisions there, and we had to learn on the fly. Once the building was operating for about 2 years, we finally determined that we were spending way too much money on air conditioning that whole space. So.
Absolutely. And natural sunlight, and a lot of the Leeds building design used natural sunlight.
Lots and lots of natural lighting. One of the things that we did was there's windows everywhere if you've been down to tour the building, so lots of east-facing and north-facing windows. So we get lots of natural lighting, and we also used high-efficiency compact fluorescents and high-output T5 lamps. And then we've started retrofitting some of those fixtures with LEDs at this point. So yeah. We're really trying to, you know, continue to push the envelope there on our sustainability efforts.
I saw on your website that you're also using some solar panels to generate electricity. Is that still part of the project?
Absolutely, yeah. We have part of a light well. So part of the natural lighting that we do, we have some light wells that come down into the interior spaces of the building that actually light a second floor space. So in a three-story building, we have a light well that comes down directly into the second floor and interior office spaces. So those are north-facing monitors, so there's glass facing to the north, so we get natural lighting that way. But on the south side, it's a 45-degree angle that was lending itself perfectly for solar panels. So a couple years ago, in 2010, I think it was, we put in 20 kilowatts of solar capacity, and we're generating a couple of megawatts a month out of that.
Do you know what percentage of energy that you require at the facility that comprises?
Well, sadly, even though 20 kilowatts sounds like a lot of energy, it's only about 1.5% of our total needs.
It's a fairly...
But every little bit helps.
Right, absolutely. You mentioned a tour that actually people can come down and see this facility.
Absolutely.
Where would they go to line that up?
Well, they go to our website, boulevard.com, and you can schedule a tour that way. And stop by the gift shop. They can stop by and schedule a tour or talk to people that way and find out more about the tours and find out which one is specifically geared towards them. We have several different tours. There's a regular public tour, and then there's some more in-depth tours that we can talk about sustainability and all the different things that we're doing.
Awesome. Now, you know, the brewery is located pretty much downtown. This is an urban type of – is that an advantage to you, being part of the urban core?
Well, it's both an advantage and disadvantage. It's an advantage in that we're very, very close to all of our people. So our workers are all within just a couple of miles. So we don't put people on the road driving 20, 30, 40 miles a day or you know, per trip to get to or leave work. So we're saving lots of greenhouse gas emissions and that from our location. But it's also a significant challenge to us in that we had to spend a lot of money going vertical, you know, to conserve land space. We're very, very tight. So we had to conserve land space and go vertical with our construction. Cost more money, but ultimately it delivers the results that we wanted.
Some of the other things you've mentioned on your website about sustainability, and you can find some text there if folks want to go back and review this, is that you are shooting towards a zero landfill goal. Now, can you explain first what that is and then how you anticipate getting there?
Yes. Well, I'm happy to say that we're not just shooting towards the zero landfill. We've been there since 2010. And we were, in our estimation, every bit of information we can gather, we're the first brewery in the country to do that. But zero landfill means that of all the materials that come into the facility, none of them end up in a landfill, nothing. Everything is recycled, reused, or at the very least sent to a cement plant where they make it back into a cement mixture as part of the furnace, whether it's alternative solid fuel or part of their admixture for that material.
I think anyone, you know, interested in the business angle would ask whether does that cost you money? Has it helped your bottom line? What's the impact of that?
Yeah, when we started looking at this program in 2009, our hope was that we could break even in this process, to go to do the right thing and not spend more money doing it. But I'm really happy to say that we found that we're actually making money. So we turned a negative, so the amount of money that we were spending on disposal, actually we're making that much money back. So we flipped it around 180 degrees. So we went from, for example, $20,000 per year for trash removal. We're actually making $20,000 a year on our recycling operation.
So greening your beer can actually help economically.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Very doing awesome. Good by doing good. That's,
and
that's
the packaging, you have kind of a unique packaging approach as well.
Very unique, yeah. Our boxes are all recycled content or very, very high percentage recycled content. And it's really unique in the beer industry in that it's a fully enclosed box. But the design of the box itself lends itself to reuse. So we found as we were building our new packaging line in 2008, we actually contemplated going to a standard, what's called an RSC box, where it's not very reusable. But we got a lot of pushback internally and externally from the fact that we were going to remove our tuck-in flaps, the resealable nature of the box. So we decided to go ahead and adjust our new packaging line to handle that old style box, and people are still use them every day. So,
And I speak to that personally.
sounds like it.
We built a camper, you know, out of our Tacoma truck and put your boxes fit underneath the bunks beautifully. So when we come to the campsite and pull out our gear, the name is there.
And they're rugged enough to reuse often, aren't they?
They're tough boxes there. And because we try different varieties, each box has its own content. Easy to identify that way. And doing the recycled paper actually helps save trees. I mean, we're not having to use virgin paper to make these boxes. Saves a lot of water. There were some numbers on the website that are probably old numbers from 2012. Over 4 million gallons of fresh water. And I don't know whether that was for 3 years or 1 year. You know, the timeline isn't here, but that's a lot of water.
And that's only on the box themselves.
Right,
the boxes
production
themselves.
Of the box. Well, we'll talk about water. Yeah, you want to do that? Let's talk about water efforts, because water in Kansas just becomes more and more important. And
yes,
what's
in Kansas
going on
City,
at the brewery?
It's a big deal.
There's a lot of water in beer. So what's going on, you know,
well,
where do you get
we're
it?
We're very fortunate to have a great water source. Kansas City, Missouri does a great job with water. It's really excellent quality, but we use a lot of it. We use now over 2 million gallons of water a month, so we're a big consumer. But as part of our efforts when we looked at our zero landfill initiative, this was actually part of a much broader program, which was our sustainability efforts as a whole, or resource efficiency. So we count utilities as one of our resources, and water, since that's such a big number for us and a big impact, we really put a lot of effort into reducing our water consumption. So since 2010, when we launched the program, we've actually cut our water consumption by 35%. So we actually use less water now in 2013, we use less water than we used in 2010, making 30% more beer last year than we used then. So it's a significant impact for us on the bottom line again, you know, so this was a really good business move, but it's also good from a sustainability and community standpoint.
Now, the flip side of water use is water disposal.
Exactly.
And the making an organic product sometimes has issues with wastewater. Have you worked with the city on that? Are there any issues with your wastewater effluent?
We've worked a lot with the city, especially recently. We're required to obtain or hold a certain level of discharge parameters, and most specifically a pH control we have to do for our effluent. And given that we're making an organic or natural product, we use lots of water. We have to do lots of cleaning because we're a non-pasteurizing brewery. So we do lots of cleaning, and the chemicals themselves have pH swings. So we have to control our pH really to keep it within that band for the city's requirements. But the city has been very, very good to us, and we're actually getting ready to install a new system at the brewery later this summer. We'll put a system that will be a series of underground tanks that will provide quite a bit of storage and natural buffering, and then be able to sustain us for a longer term.
Are you able to reuse any of the effluent? Are you able to recycle it in the plant at all?
We don't reuse it internally because to do that sort of thing requires a lot of space. And given that we are in the inner city, we don't have the space to be able to put the systems in. And that, you know, since we're making a good for human consumption, we have to be really sensitive to that fact that it's got to be perfect quality for us to be able to reuse.
Do you see any other types of efforts that are, you know, not in place now, you know, increasing sustainability in the future?
Well, we're working on our vehicle fleet. We have some hybrid vehicles that we use around the brewery for our salespeople. We're also looking at our truck fleet. We shuttle beer back and forth from the brewery itself over to our distribution center. So we spend a lot of miles on the road each year. So we're trying to find good, intelligent ways to save fuel in that sense. But the hybrid vehicles themselves are actually a significant bonus for us.
So. You still have a recharging station on the site?
We do have a vehicle recharging station down there, and people are starting to use it finally after a couple of years of hit and miss. You know, one vehicle a month, now we're getting a couple of vehicles a month or a couple a week even. So, yeah, people are starting to use it finally.
You know, I think some of our local beer drinkers were a little disturbed when Boulevard was sold to another company. And, you know, we've received many assurances that nothing's changing down there, basically. What about this commitment to sustainability? Have you felt any pushback, or are they with you all the way?
Well, they're with us all the way, first and foremost. But also, as you can see from what we've talked about here, it makes good business sense to do all the things that we're doing. So we're not being foolish with the money. This is not following some, you know, utopian dream or something. This is really, it makes good sense to do the things we're doing. So they're right with us.
Are there other breweries around the country that are trying to do some of these things too? And, you know, don't want to promote your competitors, but are you the only company out there doing this?
No, certainly not. There's a good example of a company that's doing it right is Sierra Nevada, and they've done great things with alternative fuels. They use biogas to fire fuel cells. They do lots of alternative things, solar panels like crazy. So they've done a great thing. New Belgium, of course, lots of people know them and their wind energy that they do, buying credits and whatnot. But I think that we're right up there in the tops as far as leading our community in sustainability efforts.
And you have the advantage of the shorter transportation issue, and that's significant, isn't it, in the beer industry?
Yeah, of course. Beer is really heavy, and it costs a lot to ship. You're shipping by weight, typically. More weight costs more in fuel. So shipping beer all over the country costs a lot, but you know, it's a delicate balance for us to try to figure out where do we sell beer and, you know, what beers go there, and to make sure that we have the right mix of local and regional and national distribution.
And it isn't just the cost, it's the emissions as well from the trucks. That is considerable, too.
Absolutely.
So drinking locally is also a little greener.
It is,
for
absolutely.
The consumer to make that choice. Mike, lots of stuff going on. Is there anything that we've missed that you'd like to talk about and the greening your beer efforts?
Well, just one little point here, and related to greenhouse gas emissions, I think it ties into the next segment really well, in that our greenhouse gas emissions through the Ripple Glass Initiative that we started, we've had a great impact on greenhouse gas emissions, especially locally, because of all the energy savings that Owens Corning realizes through the use of our cullet. So we feel like we've more than offset our impact on society here for that.
And Boulevard was the business that initiated the Ripple Glass recycling.
Absolutely, yeah. It was totally spawned off the idea of John McDonald and I having quite a bit of frustration as we were working through our zero landfill, getting frustrated by not having something to do with our glass that we were a significant impact on. You know, most of our beer bottles were sold in Kansas City at that time, so we felt like that we were a significant part of the problem, or at least part of the problem. And then finally, we thought that we need to be part of the solution, too. So that was how we started the Ripple Glass idea.
Well, we're going to take a break right now, and we'll be right back, listeners, talking about Ripple Glass and why it's doing such a good job here in Kansas City.
Hi, I'm Vicki Robin, author of Blessing the Hands That Feed Us, What Eating Closer to Home Can Teach Us About Food, Community, and Our Place on Earth. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about relational eating.
New Dimensions airs at 5 a.m. on Tuesdays.
Wednesday was an historic day.
It was?
Hey, this is your old pal Mike Murphy. You know, I was born on Wednesday, and I'm here to tell you that this Wednesday's child is full of whoa. So join me each and every Wednesday morning until 8 a.m. for music from around the world and around the block. Your Wednesday morning buzz, going 10 years strong.
The wonder of it all, baby.
On Wednesday, all the malls across America connected.
Outspoken fighter against Kansas City's Pendergast machine, American fascism, red baiting, and other social ills of the 20s and 30s. L.M. Burkhead left a remarkable legacy of progressive activism, including the pastorship of the All Souls Church in the 1920s. We will hear from his biographer, Jim Grebe, on this Wednesday's edition of the All Souls Forum at noon right here on KKFI.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Every living thing out there is as important as my life and as necessary to defend as my children's lives. If you felt like that, this would be a vastly different society.
I'm Neil Harvey. This week we explore indigenous peace technologies, the ancient art of getting along. On The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
That's Friday morning at 9:30.
Welcome back to Eco Radio, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And this is Elaine Giesel, your host for tonight. Our subject is greening your beer in honor of St. Patrick's Day. Hope everyone is having a great evening and a safe and healthy, maybe, drinking experience. I'd like to start this segment of the show with a very short story. We're going to open it with a classical storyteller opening from the Ashanti people of Africa. We do not really mean that what we are about to say is true. A story. Let it come, let it go. The native people of the Akoma Pueblo of this nation tell an ancient story of recycling. Pueblo Indian women crafted clay pots that lasted for years of use. When the pots eventually broke, they were not thrown into a dump. The broken pots were crushed down to a fine clay powder. The powder was then soaked to soften it to a workable clay consistency, or dough. This recovered clay was then used to make strong and beautiful new pots. Today we use many materials once and then consider them waste. Like broken pots, these materials are actually precious resources. We're all learning that we cannot afford to continue throwing away resources in our garbage cans. Our task now is to redevelop the age-old art of recycling. And the closing of the story is, this is my story which I have related. If it be sweet or if it be not sweet, take some elsewhere and let some come back to me. And the sum that is coming back to me today will be coming from Michelle Goth. She is program manager at Ripple Glass, which is located physically in the West Bottoms area now, right?
That's correct. Our administrative offices are in the West Bottoms. Our physical plant is around Truman and 435, so about a mile north of the Truman Sports Complex.
When in the previous segment, Mike Gutz referred to Boulevard initiating a glass recycling effort, which became known as Ripple Glass. We might talk about why Ripple Glass. That's an interesting idea, too. But why should we bother recycle glass? Mike said that Boulevard was shooting for a zero landfill goal, and this was part of it. But are there other reasons to recycle glass, Michelle?
Yeah, there are many. First and foremost, recycling glass, it's easy. It's a material that can be endlessly recycled. One bottle can create one new bottle without having any additives added to it. You also have to consider that there's quite a bit of energy savings. So if someone like Owens Corning, who uses our recycled glass cullet, uses the cullet instead of raw ingredients, they can operate their furnaces at a lower temperature, and there's an estimated about a 30% energy savings for someone who does that instead of using raw materials.
Well, slow down a little. Now, okay. We call it. You're throwing a lot of words out here. Now, Owens Corning manufactures what?
Owens Corning manufactures insulation, so all specifically right. Fiberglass insulation.
And they use cullet. Is that a kind of glass?
Cullet is recycled glass product, so it's what we create. So we'll collect your used bottles, and then we take it to our plant at Truman Run 435, and we will sort it, crush it down, clean it, and we get it ready for remanufacturing.
Now, before there was Ripple Glass, I know that I worked in recycling also down in Johnson County. This cullet was collected in small amounts, relatively small, but it was sent out of state, wasn't it? In Oklahoma or somewhere was the nearest place
to
haul this?
It was likely sent to Oklahoma, and it was likely collected as separate colors. So you had to put your clear together, you had to put your green together,
right.
And it was sent to a bottler. So
right, and then the transfer, as fuel prices went up, that distance and transporting
correct.
What is basically, cullet, it doesn't have by itself a high value in recycling.
No, it doesn't.
So it turned out that the fuel cost for shipping it to Oklahoma outweighed its value as a feedstock or anything. I want to back up a little bit because I know that when I do talk to people about recycling, especially, I don't know why, maybe it's a more elderly population element, we're used to sorting glass
mm-hmm.
and
sure.
being able to put it out on the curb, and there's a lot of pushback. Why can't we still put glass out in our recycling bin, you take just about everything else. And I hear that complaint, even though glass constitutes, do you know what proportion of the waste stream? Do you know? It's 3% or less,
about
I think.
5%?
Yeah. Yeah. Most grocery stores don't do it anymore because mm-hmm. of, liability issues and weight. But, you know, is there a reason it can't go into the recycling bin?
Yes, there is. There's a good reason. Whenever it's collected together with other recyclables, glass will typically break at some point in the process, whether it's in the bin, in the truck, or when it gets dumped at the recycling facility. All the materials, they're put together in your bin, but they do have to be sorted out in order to be recycled. So you'll sort out the plastics, sort out the cardboard, etc. Glass typically will be broken in that process, and it'll wedge into the paper, wedge into the cardboard. It devalues those materials that are typically the higher value materials in the recycling stream. And also the glass that's extracted from that process is typically too contaminated with other materials for us to really do anything with it. That's something that it's very popular right now to move to that single bin at the curb, and we certainly understand why. But you have to understand that glass in that mix is really an issue for most communities.
It was my understanding in talking to some of the folks who run the materials recovery facilities, these
mm-hmm.
MRFs, where we get all the commingled recyclable materials, that the glass actually physically damages conveyor
yes.
belts that move materials around within the facility and to the various sorting operations that are, some are done mechanically and some are actually still done by people.
Correct.
People, the pickers at the top who have to remove material. So glass physically endangers them, breaks material, contaminates the other recyclables. Mm-hmm. So for our listeners who have complained that why can't we still put glass in the bin, there are three important reasons. So instead, yes, it's up to you to deliver this material now, and we hope you will do so. There are many bins available, mm-hmm. and they're a funny color.
Yes, they are purple.
And why are they purple?
We wanted something that was distinctive. I think you think of green for recycling, but you see green containers everywhere. I wanted something that was distinctive. Couldn't tie-dye them, you know, so purple seemed like a good choice.
Is there a history to the name for Ripple? I'm just curious. I haven't seen this story.
Yes. Ripple Glass, I think there were several names considered, but we really wanted Ripple to cause a ripple effect. And so we operate in Kansas City. Kansas City is our home. It's where we get most of our glass from. But it's actually spread throughout the communities around us. So we operate in a 5-state region now, servicing communities like Lawrence, Kansas, and Omaha, and Jefferson City, Missouri, Springfield, Missouri. And so having Ripple Glass in Kansas City has really opened up the possibility of recycling glass in surrounding communities.
And the Owens Corning that you referred to that manufactures this glass wool, the insulation material, mm-hmm. is also located here.
Yes.
In Kansas City. So again, the transportation piece of this, hauling in glass cullet long distances, disappears. And are we supplying enough to keep Owens Corning happy?
No, we are not.
No.
They could take everything we could make. And so right now we are recycling about 20% of Kansas City's glass. We would love to get that higher. The national glass recycling rate is around 30%, so that's our next target. But we'd love to get as high as we can get, and Owens Corning can take whatever we can make. So.
And do they take all kinds of glass then? What do you, we've got these bins now that we can go chunk this stuff, and it doesn't matter what color it is, but there are different kinds of glass as mm-hmm. well. What's the issue on what you can put in there?
Right. You can put all colors of glass in there right now, and we have the equipment that we need to sort out brown glass. We actually send that to be made into new bottles down in southern Missouri. And then the remainder stays together and is crushed into a very fine cullet, kind of like a sand material, and that's what ends up going to Owens Corning.
What about mirrors or glass panes if you replace your windows? Mm-hmm. Are there some things you don't want in there that are glass?
Sure. Mirrors are certainly a problem for us. The reflective coating, we can't accept the chemicals that are in that coating, so we can't process mirrors. We can sometimes take window glass, but we prefer that you contact us before you put it in the bin. We need the frames removed. We need to make sure that it doesn't have certain types of coating or films on it. So it's just something to contact us before you would do that.
What about labels on the bottles? I mean, come on, some of us are compulsive label peelers when we sit and drink.
Sure.
But do we have to take labels off before we put them in the bin?
You certainly can if you enjoy it, and I'm one of those too. You don't have to. Our equipment is such that as it gets crushed up, typically the paper there will kind of peel off and we can slough it off. And so that's not something you have to do. You also don't have to rinse your bottles. You may want to if you store your recycling bin inside just for smell reasons. But someone like me who stores it outside, I typically am not going to rinse my bottles out.
So it isn't a problem. That's good to know.
No, it's not a problem.
Is there anything else that you can make out of this recycled glass? At one time I heard there was maybe a countertop material that was available.
Sure. We are actually experimenting right now with solid surfaces. They're actually really beautiful. Go to our website. You can see a few pictures of them. And it's a nice aggregate for solid surfaces like that. There are other things that you can make with recycled glass. You can put it as aggregates for sandblasting, and there's a lot of things you can do with it. We really love the countertop idea. It's something beautiful you can have in your home, business. You can see an example at Taco Republic over in Mission, I believe. They have a beautiful countertop that we made for them.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. I guess what I would like to know now is, would individuals be able to look at any of this facility, or is this too dangerous for people to go visit?
It is typically too dangerous. It's a heavy industrial facility. We would love to offer tours, but we just can't for that reason. On our website, on the About Us page, there is a video. It's about 7 minutes long, but it is in-depth look at how Ripple Glass operates, the input and output at our plant, how we process the glass. It's a really, really great video that we just released. I think can be used lots of in schools or in different educational capacities.
You mentioned specifically that the amber, the brown glass, was segregated out. Now, can you tell me, as just a wonk here, how do they do that? I mean, you've got broken glass. Is there a machine that does this automatically?
There is. Probably the coolest piece of equipment we have is the laser sorter. It's an optical sorter. We can program it to sort out any color, but we have specifically programmed it to sort out brown. And so it's looking through, identifying brown pieces of glass, and then it will blow a puff of air and sort it onto a different conveyor belt. So that's definitely the coolest part, and you can see that in the video.
Oh, that is cool. And that particular part of that glass waste stream is then going back to be made into Boulevard bottles.
Correct.
Because you have amber bottles.
Yes, and we thought that was important to have that bottle-to-bottle reincarnation. So it goes into Boulevard bottles and a lot of other craft beer and other brewers that use that bottling plant.
Well, that raises the question then of why go through that process and why not just reuse the bottles? And I don't know if Mike wants to take
Mike is a good person to answer this.
Well, let's add that to this discussion then. Why not just reuse? We used to. I mean, I remember taking bottles back and reusing bottles.
Yeah, we certainly looked at that in evaluation of the Ripple Glass program. How could we effectively recycle glass here in Kansas City? So I looked at it specifically about reuse, and there's many challenges with that. The first of which is that nobody makes heavyweight bottles that can be reused anymore. So we all use lightweight glass, and that comes from the manufacturers. They're trying to save money too. And also, back to your transportation issue, glass is heavy, so the thicker wall of the glass bottle that it takes to be reused over and over again is more costly to ship to us, the consumer or the user of the bottle. But then beyond that, I think one of the most critical issues that we determined is if we designed a program only for our glass bottle at Boulevard Brewing Company, what does that do for all the other glass that's consumed in Kansas City? It gives us no outlet. There's no system to handle all the other glass, like the mayonnaise jars and the salsa jars and the pickles and spirits jars or jugs. So when you add all those things together, it takes a broader program to be able to do something with that. So, yeah, a reusable program, if we could have realistically gotten bottles that would be reusable, maybe we could have designed a program for that, but it wouldn't solve the greater issue of glass recycling in the city.
Excellent, and that's a good answer. I'm glad to hear that. I know that storing bottles at home can be something of a problem, and there are small plastic Ripple bins available, and they would go to the Ripple Glass site to get a bin if they wanted one?
Yes, we have them available for purchase online, so you can opt to do that, and then we have a local courier that would deliver it to your doorstep. You can also find several locations to buy one at Price Chopper and liquor stores and things like that. So you have two options to buy that. We also have people use, you name it, kitty litter pails, Rubbermaid bins. Anything works as long as it keeps the glass together.
In fact, the Boulevard boxes are very handy.
Yes,
for
they are.
We're putting them back into when they're empty. That's true. And that does bring up one problem. I've heard, and I'm not sure whether it's legitimate, people complain, well, you know, folks go there and they throw the whole box into the bin.
Yes.
And that's not appropriate, is it?
It isn't. We get quite a bit of boxes and bags, things that people use to carry their glass. So we would ask that you just put the glass in the bin and then take those items back home to be recycled or reused again.
And that's something, too, for local businesses who host these bins. This is something you arrange with a local business or community?
Both. We have both city-hosted bins and several grocery stores, liquor stores that host bins for us. We have over 100 drop-off points now.
How would you find one?
You would go to the website, go to the How to Recycle tab, and then you'll find a map. You can put in your zip code, and it'll pull up everything that's in your vicinity. So our ideal situation is that in the Kansas City metro, you're no greater than 5 minutes away from a bin.
I've heard some complaint from folks who live far out in the rural community saying they have to go so far to find the bin. But that's a question of whether it's economically feasible to get enough glass over time and to make that pull back to the facility.
Yeah, and what we suggest is if you're making an errand, into town, that's a good time to bring it. So it's a lot of times in the rural communities, it is harder for us to place a bin there. Just we don't get as much glass from them, and then hauling it to us is cost prohibitive and energy intensive. And
I just want people to understand that there are sustainable reasons not to have them way out in the country.
Yes.
And if you are a beer drinker or whatever, you usually these bins are, or some of them at least, are located near liquor stores.
Absolutely.
So that you bring the old ones back when you get the new ones. That works. There's some concern that broken glass is found around the bins, although I've not seen that commonly, but some folks have been reluctant to allow a bin on their facility because they're afraid of boxes being left behind or glass being broken. Is that a common complaint, or do we just deal with it?
It does
pick it up.
It does happen, and if you think having over 100 drop-off locations in the city, the amount of issues we have is really pretty minimal. We have really great host businesses and host cities that they'll go out and sweep up around the bins. They'll pick up boxes left behind. We also do that. So I think that us, in partnership with our hosts, we do as good as we can to keep the bins clean and to keep the area around it safe.
And I would urge listeners who use these bins, you know, to be responsible citizens as well. Don't throw the extraneous material in there. Take it back. And I know that we do. We use the same boxes over and over for recycling. We just throw them in the back end and set them out where they belong in the garage. And we don't make trips often. I mean, that's something for sustainability, too. Allow material to build up a little bit rather than taking a six-pack at a time.
Right.
Do it smart. These are all excellent suggestions. I'm glad to see it done. I realize it does put the onus on the consumer to return the glass to the bins, but there are more and more of them out there all the time. Some cities, I know I live in Overland Park in Johnson County, and there have been some issues about screening these big purple dumpsters. I guess they are not appropriate eye candy on the street, which I would disagree with as someone who's an environmental activist. But, you know, you can also press your local elected officials that if there are ordinances, and talk to them. Let's see if we can change it.
Absolutely. There are a few municipalities in Kansas City that there are screening requirements. They want it somewhat blocked from view from the streets. We've been fairly lucky, especially with Overland Park, in getting exceptions to that. So they do see the value in having that there for their residents.
And it is value. You know, there's an upcoming event that I know that both Boulevard and Ripple Glass are involved in the planning of, called Boulevardia. And it has hit the media. I've seen several things in the paper already, and availability of tickets and so on. This is happening this summer.
Yes.
On Father's Day weekend.
Yes.
That's for those of you who don't have your calendars handy. June 13th through 15th. It's a 2.5-day, would you call it a street festival? How would you describe it?
I think a street festival is appropriate, and it's really it's a chance for Boulevard to celebrate everything that's good about Kansas City. It's really about community. There's going to be local bands playing. There will be a few national touring acts playing Saturday night. So it's going to be a fun event, something that you can just come and enjoy with your friends or family.
But there are family activities as well.
Yes,
so, and it's a daytime. It's all night and all
absolutely.
Not night.
And we have some really cool stuff coming on the eco side. We have an eco village, is kind of what we're calling Eco Expo, where we're going to have interactive exhibits, and your kids can learn about local farming, urban farming, you know, wastewater, energy efficiency. There will be a lot of different things, and it'll all be really fun and interactive. It's not just people handing out pamphlets. It'll be cool and definitely an educational environment. Past that, we'll also feature local makers of goods. So people who are really making things on a local scale and doing good work in that way, they're going to have a maker fair that you can explore.
Sustainability is part of that. And I assume there'll be some recycling going on there,
yes,
too.
Yes, of course. Yes, there will be recycling at the event. We're looking at food waste and everything we can do to make the event a green event.
And this was going to take place where?
It will be in the West Bottoms. So it will take up several city blocks within the West Bottoms, and also the 12th Street Bridge will be occupied by this event.
And I understand that it does require a ticket for admittance. And
correct.
To learn more about that, and depending how many days you go and whatever you're involved in, the beer tasting area is going to be separate, require separate tickets.
Yes.
So kids aren't going to wander in there. This is, you know, still family focused. So to learn more about getting tickets, where would you send folks?
There is a website, boulevardia.com.
but the focus is sustainable beer, greening your
yes.
beer. I want to thank you both for being with me today, Mike Utz from Boulevard Beer and Michelle Goth from Ripple Glass, and maybe we can discuss this further. Wish all of our listeners who are still listening to the radio on St. Patrick's Day evening a safe and happy holiday today out on the streets. Be careful. Thank you for joining us.
This is Naturally with your events around the Kansas City community area. Kristen Riott, Director of Bridging the Gap, will give an overview of freshwater issues globally, nationally, and locally, including how water is used at home, the energy nexus, and a summary of Bridging the Gap's recent work with citizens on water conservation. This presentation, called Blue is the New Green, Water Issues in the 21st Century, is offered by Village U and Village Presbyterian Church on March 18th from 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. It's located at Village Presbyterian Church in Prairie Village, Kansas, and walk-ins are welcome. Work the farm at Gibbs Road Farm. Get your hands dirty and learn alongside urban farmers at Cultivate Kansas City's Work the Farm Day at Gibbs Road Farm. Volunteers should wear weather-appropriate clothing and closed toe shoes that can get dirty. Gloves and tools will be provided, and in case of rain or inclement weather, an email notification will be sent if the event is canceled. This event is from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. March 22nd at Gibbs Road Farm in Kansas City, Kansas. Sign up yourself or a group at the link posted on our Facebook page via greenabilitymagazine.com. And if you are listening from the Lawrence, Kansas area, Lawrence Bicycle Advisory Committee will be meeting Tuesday, March 18th at 5 p.m. at the Lawrence Parks and Recs Conference Room 1141 on Massachusetts Street. The March agenda includes the multimodal final plan, bicycle pedestrian advocacy groups, and bicycle rideability map. The Bicycle Advisory Committee works to improve bicycle safety and awareness through education of motorists and non-motorists, develops bicycle plans and maps, and advises the city and county commissions on bicycle priorities and needs. The agenda and information can be downloaded at lawrenceks.org. The 14th annual Kansas City Eat Local and Organic Food Expo is coming up. There are two events, the first being Saturday, March 29th, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Johnson County Community College, and the second at Penn Valley Community College on Saturday, April 12th, from 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. There will be local growers of organic and free-range produce selling their wares, including garden plants starts, as well as free organic gardening information and free 2013 producers directory. This year, the expo will feature a series of short documentary films as well as a presentation on biodiversity by Slow Food of Kansas City. Both food expos are free admission with free parking and free music.
All right, and thank you very much for all those calendar information. This is Mike Murphy here on Eco Radio KC. We're going to close out the program in a few minutes with Harvey Wasserman, who's a nuclear activist, on the third anniversary of Fukushima. A little update what's going on in there. But in the meantime, thought maybe we could let you know about some other things that are coming up on KKFI. Well, tomorrow morning on New Dimensions, if you are one of those early risers that enjoy KKFI's 5 a.m. programs, it's Vicki Robin, and she's speaking on eating local as an act of belonging. And that really connects you to your community and to where you are. That's New Dimensions tomorrow morning at 5. Making contact on 12:30 on Thursday, 12:30 p.m., that's lunchtime. Making Contact has a program on How Long is Forever, about the long, long half-lives of nuclear elements and how we can never really get rid of the waste. That's on Making Contact at Thursday at 12:30 p.m. And then on Bioneers on Friday morning at 9:30, it's Indigenous Peace Technologies, the Ancient Art of Getting Along. So those are just a couple of things coming up on KKFI. And what have we got going on Eco Radio next Monday?
Next Monday, we'll have an interview with John Kerman with a Keystone Pipeline update.
Yeah, John's going to bring us up to date. He's been involved in the local
resistance here. John, former host of Eco Radio KC, still very strong environmental activist. And it's even for folks like Natural E and myself, it's kind of hard to keep track of what the deal is with all the pipelines. And yes. So John's going to help us keep track of what's what.
Looking forward to that.
The public comment period closed last week, and but what does that mean? And then there's also the issue of what's going on in Nebraska. There's some landowners got an injunction. What is President Obama going to do? And what about the Flanagan pipeline, all these pipelines, how they connect? And there's a lot to kind of catch up on. And so if anyone can help do that, that'll be John Kerman. And that's on Monday, Eco Radio, week from tonight.
Mm-hmm, the 24th.
That's right. Oh, and one other quick programming note. Vermin Supreme, that perennial presidential candidate, is going to be a guest on Mic Check tomorrow night at 6 p.m. He's going to be here in town and stopping here in the studio on his way to his appearance at Open Fire Pizza at 7. And then the following week, we have a mystery show.
Yes, a mystery show hosted by Mr. Craig Lubo.
So the suspense should be killing you, and hope you can tune in. And, of course, if you came in late to the program, these are podcasts. Sometime tomorrow, we'll have this up for you on kkfi.org. You can always listen, and you can listen to past weeks. We go back several months, and it's a great way to catch up. So I think we're going to sign off now. Do we have anything else we have to say?
It.
I think that's it. Thanks for listening, and do stay tuned for Betty Norris and Sabor Latino. Betty celebrating 10 years at KKFI.
Wow.
So if we call in and give her your congratulations.
March 11th marked the third anniversary of the devastating earthquake and tsunami that struck Japan's coastline, killing more than 15,000 people and leaving 300,000 homeless. The earthquake also triggered the triple meltdown and four explosions at the Fukushima nuclear power complex located near the epicenter of the tremor. Since the tsunami destroyed the nuclear reactor's backup cooling systems, there have been continuing leaks of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. Contaminated water is being stored in 1,200 tanks located on the Fukushima site, but they are prone to leaks. While the Tokyo Electric Company and Japanese government are expecting a 30 to 40 year time frame to decommission the failed reactors, they say their urgent mission is to dispose of the contaminated water, the most likely option being a release of the stored radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. Since the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster, scientists say as many as 20 trillion becquerels of cesium-137, 10 trillion becquerels of strontium-90, and 40 trillion becquerels of tritium were released into the Pacific Ocean. Scientists further predict that radiation from the Fukushima reactors will reach the waters off the U.S. west coast sometime this April. On the eve of the third anniversary of the earthquake and nuclear disaster, thousands of Japanese citizens protested Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's plan to reopen some of the nation's 48 nuclear plants that were closed down in 2011. Your reporter spoke with author and environmental activist Harvey Wasserman, who examines the continuing danger of the radiation leaks at Fukushima and the threat to human health and the ecosystem posed by the global nuclear power industry.
As soon as there's a nuclear accident at Chernobyl or Three Mile Island, the bomb tests in the South Pacific and Nevada, even at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, now at Fukushima, the response is instant and immediate and automatic. And it's always the same thing. Not enough radiation came out to harm anybody. Now you have all the apologists. They have no idea how much radiation escaped from Fukushima, what kind it is, where it's gone, who will be impacted. What we do know for sure, and there's one thing we know for sure, and that is that there is no safe dose of radiation. There is no number that you can assign to a dose of radiation that you can prove to be perfectly harmless. This is especially important when it comes to pregnant women, because it was shown in 1956 by Dr. Al Stewart that X-raying pregnant women led to a doubled childhood leukemia rate among their offspring. She was attacked, as you might expect, and fought for 30 years, and finally the medical profession had to concede and come around that, well, we do not x-ray pregnant women. You also wear a bib when you go in the dentist's office and the x-ray technician leaves the room. And unfortunately, we can't leave the room. In this case, it's the planet Earth. And so Fukushima has spewed out a gargantuan and continues to spew out gargantuan quantities of radiation. We do know that it will be arriving in the water on the West Coast sometime this summer. This is detectable cesium that could only be coming from Fukushima, and it is not harmless. So, you know, those of us who like to go to the beach are going to face a decision. Why should we have to face this kind of decision in the year 2014 when commercial nuclear power is an economic catastrophe? The only people who make money on nuclear power are large corporations. They're completely corporate controlled and have no really, really effective control on the part of the public. And, you know, we're seeing that at Fukushima where TEPCO is turning the cleanup into a huge profit center.
Harvey, I know you've been tracking public opinion in Japan as regards the plan by the Japanese Prime Minister to restart these nuclear power plants, the 48 nuclear power plants that were shut down after the tsunami and after the Fukushima disaster. There have been very large demonstrations against nuclear power across Japan in these intervening few years. What can you tell us about public opinion in Japan right now? Are people supportive of the government plan to restart these nuclear plants?
No, absolutely not. There's a very strong, the polls all show a very strong majority in opposition to reopening nuclear plants in Japan. You know, you have essentially a fascist government there now that has come in with American support, which is pushing to reopen these reactors and pushing to prevent the public from knowing what's going on. Spending huge amounts of money on public relations, you know, manufacturing consent, as Noam Chomsky would say, and denying the science that shows that there are dangers to the public. And then, in fact, there has been a spike in thyroid abnormalities. You know, this is a very, very ugly situation.
What is the situation with seafood that is fished out of the Pacific Ocean? Tuna, for instance, migrate around some of the currents that bring the waters near Fukushima up towards the Aleutian Islands and down the West Coast. Is there anybody or any agency measuring the potential radiation in seafood that's sold in U.S. markets?
Not that I know of. There was some testing done on tuna in Southern California, and every tuna they tested showed radiation from Fukushima. And it is traceable. There's certain isotopes of cesium, tellurium, and some other elements that are clearly related to the disaster. So seafood has become problematic, but there's no one giving you hard numbers. And I don't think that's an accident. The radiation is pouring into the Pacific. And we don't know, you know, there's no studies on the long-term health impacts on starfish, on sea lions, on sardines, on salmon, you know, on other species. Nobody has that, not those numbers. And so when these people tell you that, the amounts are too tiny to harm anything, there's no data to show that. And so these denials are completely commercial-based. The one good piece of news is that solar energy is proceeding, green power, renewables, efficiency, conservation, these technologies have exploded in a good way, so that renewables are much, much cheaper than nuclear, much cheaper than much of the fossil fuel industry now. They are terrified of renewables. But this revolution is happening, and we can't make it come fast enough. The most important thing we can do to save this planet is to shut the nuclear reactors as soon as possible, but before the next Fukushima, for God's sakes.
That was Harvey Wasserman, editor at nukefree.org and author of Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth. Find links to Wasserman's articles and more information on the Fukushima disaster on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
You're listening.
listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Están escuchando KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Radio de la Comunidad.